But I don't think there's any single person that truly and deeply understands the entire thing. It is a huge spending bill. It is one way you can think of it. But there are some core components to the farm bill that go back to when we had our first farm bills during the Great Depression. There's three things you need to know. It's a safety net for hungry people. It's a safety net for farm families, and it funds conservation program for U.S. agriculture. So those three things are 99% of the farm bill in dollar terms.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio. Revenue grew, so did your hours. The owner's box, buy back 20 a week. Stop hiring for problems automation can solve. Start with Elevate Agents. Don't hire another VA stuck in 2015. Hire a remote AI specialist from Latin who runs AI tools, works in your time zone, and helps your team move faster. Schedule your free strategy call at www.wisevas.io. Zentrix OS, the business operating system built for teams who are serious about goals, tasks, and measurable results. One platform to run your entire operation. Zentrix Insights. The right person in the right seat starts with knowing how your team is actually wired. Visit ZentrixInsights.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Leo Bastos, Assistant Professor in Integrative Precision Agriculture at the University of Georgia. Today, we'll welcome our guest, Dr. Jennifer Ift. She's a professor and Flinchbaugh Agricultural Policy Chair in the Agricultural Economics Department at Kansas State University. Jennifer, welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show. It is great to have you here with us today. And to get us started, I wanted to ask you if you can share a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today.
Right. Well, it's been a pretty long journey. Like you said, I'm a professor at Kansas State University now. Originally, I'm a farm kid from Central Illinois, so I grew up there, studied agricultural economics at University of Illinois. I did a master's degree in England. I worked in international development for a while at the World Bank before I started a PhD, University of California, Berkeley. Switched back to working on domestic agriculture, which is really my focus now. Spent some time at the U.S. Department of Agriculture Economic Research Service. I was a professor at Cornell University for a while, and now I'm at Kansas State University. So I have lived in a lot of different places. Right now I'm as close to home as I've ever been, and I'm loving it.
Nice. That sounds like a very exciting path. Lots of cool places and great experiences, I would imagine. Can you share with us a little bit about what do you work with and what are some projects you're currently working on?
So my focus here at Kansas State University is agricultural policy. I teach an undergraduate agricultural policy course. I have extension responsibilities, so sort of outreach or sort of, you know, extension beyond the or education beyond the university. So I do a lot of work on crop, livestock, and forage insurance, educating producers about new programs or sharing analysis of existing programs. I also do work on farm bill education. I have a research program. I work with a lot of great graduate students. So I'm interested in non-traditional finance, forage economics, and hay markets, doing a little bit of work on the profitability of regenerative agriculture, also research on crop insurance and farm program payments and how that affects farm level decisions.
Awesome. That's really exciting. And so of all those very interesting topics, today we're going to narrow a little bit more on the farm policy and farm bill especially. So can you explain to us what is the farm bill? What is its role and who writes it? Who approves it?
Right. So what's the farm bill? It's kind of an existential question. What is the farm bill? I don't think there's any single person that truly and deeply understands the entire thing. It is a huge spending bill. is one way you can think of it. But there are some core components to the Farm Bill that go back to when we had our first Farm Bills during the Great Depression. There's three things you need to know. It's a safety net for hungry people. It's a safety net for farm families, and it funds conservation program for U.S. agriculture. So those three things are 99% of the Farm Bill in dollar terms. It should be called a food and farm bill because the nutrition part, the safety net for hungry people, hungry Americans, that's about 75-80% of Farm Bill spending. It's a huge social safety net program. So that would be SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, used to be called food stamps, school lunches, things like that. So that's the food part of the Farm Bill. The farm part of the Farm Bill, it's our farm safety net, and it's funding for conservation programs on U.S. farms and ranches. That's not everything. There's another part of the Farm Bill that I like to call the 1%. And that 1% is pretty important from public goods perspective. So I'll start with research, since I work at a university. That's a big one. There's funding for our extension system, the Forest Service. There's funding for rural development, funding for rural governments, food safety. There's all kinds in there. So awful lot in a Farm Bill. It's a piece of legislation that, you know, we've had Farm Bills since the 1930s. They are typically 5 years before they expire. Recently, you get a couple extensions. You don't get a new Farm Bill every 5 years, but they do tend to keep, they have always kept funding for Farm Bill programs for various reasons. So it affects all Americans one way or the other. And it's definitely important for rural America, for both the farm and food parts of the Farm Bill.
Awesome. This is, thanks for really going, you know, I know it's a very complex topic, but I think I really appreciate your explanation here, defining those main pillars. So thanks for that. So, you know, talking a little bit more about the Farm Bill. So from your perspective, and especially in extension, working with growers, working with the public that is affected by what's in the Farm Bill, what are the most important changes that growers should be paying attention right now, and why?
Right. Well, we are in Farm Bill update season, so the timing is certainly good for the question. So the current Farm Bill that we are in is the 2018 Farm Bill. We are in our third extension of that Farm Bill, which is the first time. One or two extensions are normal. Three is a lot. So the Farm Bill is pretty old. The big change was the summer. So we had, I don't know, it's some, what we're calling the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. It's just a string of numbers otherwise. OB3. And that was a budget reconciliation, but it was a budget bill. But that act did make some important changes to some Farm Bill programs, not so much related to the design of programs, but the support levels. What it did was it, a couple different things. So on the, depending on what side of the aisle you're on, it had reforms or cuts to the nutrition program. So lowered expected expenditure on federal nutrition programs. That's one part of it. For the farm programs, it increased spending somewhat, or it made some increases permanent in conservation spending, and it increased the farm safety net in a couple different ways. So those changes to the farm safety net, that's what we're doing in our extension education efforts now. It's the winter, it's meeting season for farmers and for extension. So, you know, it's when people aren't in the field and, you know, you have time for education. I was just at one early today with some mostly ranchers, cow-calf producers. But for crop producers, so most of the Farm Bill is the farm safety net programs are crop related. You know, we are discussing changes to Farm Bill programs, some of the Farm Bill safety net programs and crop insurance programs that came to those changes that happened this summer that sort of strengthened the farm safety net. They increased the support levels, but they also changed how programs worked a little bit. So it's sort of, you know, thinking through what that would look like for producers and how they could use that right now. And profit margins are pretty tight for a lot of crop producers.
Perfect. And so you've mentioned a couple of times the farm safety net. Can we just go a little bit deeper in that? And could you explain to us what does that mean and what programs are actually being offered through the farm safety net?
And we could do like 6 podcasts on what the farm safety net is, but no, it's pretty straightforward. So there's three parts of the farm safety net. The sort of the foundation, we call the foundation of the farm safety net, is the federal crop insurance program. That is authorized by the Farm Bill. So it is a part of the Farm Bill, but that's kind of considered a standalone part of it. So crop insurance, it's a public-private partnership. The federal government, you know, plays a role in the design of the policies and covers part of the costs. So it's more affordable for producers. And it is today, for 3 decades, it is sort of a standard part of risk management for most U.S. crop producers of major commodities. So, you know, if you're talking about our major commodity crops, corn, soybean, Georgia, I got to say cotton and peanuts, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So it's just a sort of a standard part of risk management, the federal crop insurance program. And, you know, there's a lot of specialty crops. You know, it's expanded beyond those major crops, but for the major crops, you have something like 90% of acres. And what it does is it provides a guarantee based on current conditions for the typical crop insurance program. So you're growing corn, you know, it's going to provide you a revenue floor, basically. So it's going to say, what is your farm's yield potential? It's your expected yield, and what are current market prices? So it's providing you sort of revenue or income protection based on current conditions. So that's why it's the foundation. The next part of the farm safety net is what we call Farm Bill Commodity Program. So these come from Title I of the Farm Bill. That's terms some of your listeners might be familiar with. If they're crop farmers, they probably know about ARC and PLC. Those are the two big programs, agricultural risk coverage and price loss coverage. And these are programs that sort of kick in conceptually, they're kicking in on top of crop insurance. So, you know, sometimes your market prices are low and that gives you a low crop insurance guarantee, or sometimes, you know, crop insurance isn't going to cover those shallow revenue losses or declines in revenue. And so it's sort of designed for those periods of time where the farm economy is a little bit tighter. So you have the crop insurance program. On top of that, you have the farm bill programs, which provide extra protection, you know, generally speaking, for when there's a decline in the farm economy and those crop insurance protection is lower. And so if on top of those, you have disaster programs. And so disaster programs, some of them are from the Farm Bill. They're standing programs. They might be for forage. There's one for, I think it's called the tree. There's the tree assistance program. I think it's fruit trees or something. There's so many. There's one for honeybees and fish. They're disaster programs. So they're more in catastrophic type of situations. They're standing, implemented by the USDA Farm Service Agency. And then if all of this, you know, you have all these programs, if sort of Congress or the USDA, the executive branch, says these aren't enough, then you have ad hoc disaster programs. And that's what we've seen a lot of recently. And I could go through that more. But so that's the sort of the three pillars of the farm safety net. You have crop insurance at the foundation, Farm Bill Commodity Programs, ARC and PLC. And on top of that, you have disaster programs.
Perfect. Fantastic. Thanks for that. It's really so if we just go back to it, so that insurance program will be covering mostly perhaps a lower yield than expected, or maybe some level of unplanned losses, perhaps, whereas the commodity program is going to be more towards those prices, making sure the growers are getting a minimum payment to make it on the on the green. Right. And then disaster programs are really specific to those disaster events that may or may not happen. Is that kind of...
So for your major commodity crops, crop insurance is revenue insurance. So it's a combination of unexpected yield declines due to natural causes or a decline in sort of national price levels. And then, that's basically it.
Thanks for explaining that.
It's a lot.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And it's great to have an expert here to really, you know, distill that down a little bit and make it simpler for sure. Yeah. So, you know, when you're talking with growers and you're all working with them, or working on the education side, just like you're doing right now, how do you approach, I mean, these, you know, I'm sure the Farm Bill is something very complex with complex language and just, very lengthy. So what is your approach to really trying to make this simpler and really distill down to the main points when you are teaching your clientele? I would imagine a lot of farmers, growers, in the state.
Right. And so I think, you know, part of our job in extension land grant system is to figure out what's really important, what matters to producers, and communicate that and provide education on that. So, you know, we're supposed to go through all the legislative language, all the analysis, and then put out parts of that that we think have the most impact that producers really need to understand. And that's not dumbing things down or even necessarily simplifying, it's focusing on what's important and really matters. And that is a constant, like, it's trying to figure it all out than trying to say it clearly. It keeps me busy. That's the job. That's part of it. I think the other thing is just knowing what what's the current economic situation? What programs are they familiar with? How do they think about them? What's the language they use? And then trying to, work within that. So if you're describing a new insurance program, you say, okay, you all are used to this program. Most people use it this way. Here's how this one is different. So you're also trying to, I guess, meet people where they are is the other big part of it. But it's definitely an art and a science trying to get from what matters and how could you actually make that clear. They're not making policy simpler. They keep creating new programs. They keep making new acronyms. I need some new acronym jokes. Sometimes I just forget them in like the middle of a talk or something. It's constant.
Yeah. The federal government really likes their acronyms all across the board.
I mean, most professions have it, but I think policy is kind of special.
Awesome. So, along those lines, what are some of the most common misunderstandings or perhaps just overall challenges that you see among farmers, especially in relation to crop insurance programs?
Standard crop insurance has been around for, four major, it's a pretty well understood product. So I think there is a good level of familiarity with the standard products. I think one of the things that you, for sort of newer products or non-standard products, you hear it didn't work. And that's always, what do you mean that the insurance didn't work? And it can mean a couple things. It might mean that it said it would protect against a different risk and it didn't do it. It's literally not working. Or it was, priced like it wasn't priced right. And so that, they end up paying too much for it. And so there's, sort of technical problems with insurance, which, can and do happen. But there's also like, I didn't get a payout, which doesn't necessarily, it could mean it didn't work, but it doesn't necessarily mean it didn't work. With new programs, a lot of them aren't tied to what happens at the farm level. And so that's something that, we're constantly trying to say, hey, if something happens to you and you don't get a payout, it's working as intended. It's just not working well for you. And so we try to like you need to understand how this works in advance and when you might be disappointed and when it might work well to kind of see if you're comfortable with it. So I think this kind of, you know, helping people think more deeply about what it means for an insurance product to work and being prepared for, you know, that is one thing. I think the other thing with crop insurance right now is, I mean, they're not making it any simpler. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, risk management is complex. Our farms are complex. Our farms have different needs. And there's this flexibility with the federal crop insurance program that private companies can come in and they can work with industry to develop new products. They get approved by the Federal Crop Insurance Corporation. Some of these products have been very popular and really improve risk management. So it's a, but it's also just created a lot of new products that have to be sort of managed and people have to select between. So it comes with this complexity and increased management. So I think, part of what we do in extension is, I tend to focus on new crop insurance products, or if, let's revisit the old one and see if these choices make sense now that a few things have changed. So, you're trying to help people navigate that complexity, and you're not getting into all the complexity. You're trying to focus, okay, here's the things that are really important. So that's kind of what's on my mind these days.
Nice. So it's basically like this program's, they start offering more, perhaps more opportunities to tailor to specific situations, which ends up making it more complex, but also more, to some extent, more customized. And then that's what generates them.
That's a trade-off, though.
Yeah,
that's right. The more customized it is, the more complicated it's going to be. You just cannot get around that. And maybe with better data, it'll get better someday, but I can't.
No, absolutely. So something that, I was just thinking when you were explaining this is, we're seeing more natural disasters happening, more extremes happening in terms of weather. I think we are to expect that to probably become more common. So how do you see these programs as far as they relate to crop insurance and risk management adapting to this new normal, perhaps, of these extreme events happening more frequently?
Right. So the, again, we're gonna distill it here to your standard crop policies. There's hundreds more. Your standard crop policies, they're gonna price in risk based on historic risk, and they're gonna provide a guarantee. It's like your value of your car, right? The guarantee is your yield times market prices, right? That yield is based on historic yield. So if yields start going down, that guarantees it, crop insurance is going to update. If risk starts increasing, crop insurance is going to become more costly. And so the decrease in yields lower the cost. I mean, you have a cheaper car, it's cheaper to insure, right? From a dollar federal expenditure taxpayer dollar perspective, your risk goes up, it becomes more costly. So probably I think the net is it becomes more costly to the federal government or to the taxpayer. So that's, and there has been some studies on that. So that's one component of it. I think, so that's like kind of more from a program or federal government perspective. From the farm perspective, I mean, it's just, in Kansas. So Northeast Kansas, typically, they'd have bad yields. So it's like bad corn yields. Northeast, it's kind of the Corn Belt part of Kansas. They've had great corn yields since like 2017, just very not Kansas. And it's not really normal. Like they should have one or two bad years in there. And so they've kind of just been on a good run. The droughts haven't hit there as bad. The rest of the state, I mean, you could have, some places got hit in 2022 and 23 and 24, maybe two or three of those years, and had really poor crops. We had really large crop insurance payouts in 22 and 23. And so, crop insurance has become really important to farm viability. It's been important to lending access to credit from the beginning. So, it becomes even more important, I guess, for farms that are dealing with weather. I would say, though, we've also had policy adaptation. And it's not advertised this way, but we had, remember I talked about ad hoc programs? And so we have had additional. So one of the there's all these goals of the federal crop insurance program, you know, have high participation. Really, it's been pretty successful. One of the other goals was to limit. I'm probably going to get in trouble for this. We'll see if anyone that cares listens. But one of the other goals has been to sort of put a limit on disaster payments. And we have had additional natural disaster aid for crop producers as sort of ad hoc disaster programs on top of crop insurance that were paid out from the 2020 crop year. The most recent one was at the end of 2024. We had $20 billion, which is a big number from a foreign policy perspective, $20 billion of additional disaster aid to cover 23 and 24 on top of crop. And so crop insurance was considered to not be enough. You know, crop insurance is never going to cover the entire amount of expected revenue. Everything as a deductible. It's just good insurance principles. So, I mean, we've also seen the policy adapting to natural disasters. I think that's one way you could look at it.
Nice. No, fantastic. Thanks for sharing that. And then I guess one question here, more just from the farmer perspective or just the, you know, producer perspective, and what are the resources they have out there to be able to understand? So I understand that your role at K-State is there's a large component of educating the public, right? Is that common across the U.S. And is a university-led extension the main source of this type of education, or farmers also use other sources to understand these complexities?
Farmers are getting all kinds of information. We're just one voice out there. So on the crop insurance side, so farmers buy crop insurance from a private insurance agent. And so those agents play a primary role in education. And if they want to be, and they get the, so first of all, they can't compete on price. The prices of crop insurance are set by the federal government. Those agents are competing on service. And so, you know, part of their job is sort of that education, that one-on-one, here's your options, let's, you know, do some analysis. So, you know, some of the work I do gets used more by crop insurance. I mean, sometimes producers will go and use it. Sometimes they want to talk to an agent about something. Sometimes they want an outside voice. But a lot of times I'm providing products that agents will use, either for themselves or with their clients. And I think there's a lot of, you know, other land grants will do national or, you know, sometimes you do stuff that's nationally tailored. Sometimes I see somebody, you know, Illinois or somewhere else, they put out something cool. I'll be like, oh, maybe I could do something for Kansas. Maybe we could just use this. So there is exchange. And I think a lot of the land grants will do, especially in sort of bigger ag states, you have people working on crop insurance or policy in extension. It's a little variable just based on what the local needs are and what the department has done historically. So at K-State, I don't know if you've ever run into Art Barnaby. He's a legend. He's retired now, but he helped create revenue protection insurance, which is the major type of crop insurance that is used today. And he retired right before I came. And so, you know, we had a strong tradition of engaging with the insurance industry and producers here. And so I kept doing it. If there hadn't been that tradition, I might have had a slightly different focus. It's just, yeah, it's kind of how things work out. But, you know, a lot of times extension does play a role that, you know, if things work right, it really complements what those private insurance agents already do.
Perfect. And I think especially thinking from the perspective of, you know, university related extension is going to be an unbiased source of interpretation even, right? Whereas maybe, I mean, I don't know, I'm just, you know, coming from the crop production side, you know, we have extension, we have, you know, companies and people selling products. So is that kind of a similar feeling that growers have in crop insurance, that they get your information as more unbiased as compared to perhaps somebody that's selling a product?
And it's even if there's a new product, sometimes the insurance agent wants one of us to talk about it because it's like, okay, this is somebody that's not selling it, that's explaining it. So they'll even use that, or, you know, they'll have us out to talk about something. And so I think it is, it's definitely a big part of it. You know, also you have competing insurance agents. So if you're if there's something that's new and you want to do it like a program on it, you can't really pick one of them, but you know, we can come in and provide an overview and, you know, sort of research-based analysis, and then the agents can fill in the nitty-gritty of the program details. So it works pretty well.
All right. Well, we're getting towards the latter part of our episode. With that, we have our three questions. Before we move into that, I do want to talk with our audience. If you are enjoying this episode, this great conversation with Dr. Jennifer Ift, make sure to drop us a like, follow us on social media, share this episode with anyone else you think may benefit from this great conversation. Just make sure to check out this episode and others as well.
It's time for our famous three.
All right, Jennifer. So we get to the last three questions that we ask every guest in this podcast. And the first one of them is, I'd like to ask if you have any resource that you have found to be useful in your career on the technical side of things that you could share with us.
AgManager.info is the K-State Extension website. So we have a lot of great resources on ag policy and livestock economics there. AgriPulse, it is subscription, but it's a really great source of ag policy news. It's one that I use. They're very balanced and they just get out information really quickly. So it helps me stay on top of things. I think the other one I used, LinkedIn a lot. I call it Nerd Twitter. It helps me keep on top of research. It helps me share my own things. Things get amplified pretty well. I've noticed lately there's a lot of people from the crop insurance industry. There's lenders, there's producers on there. So that's been a really, really good platform for me to share my work and learn from others. I've been thankful for it. You know, it's hard. It's a big sort of social media ecosystem out there. So it helps a lot.
Nice. So, well, I guess just to make sure I got this right. So you said agmanager.info is the K-State resource.
K-State Ag Econ Extension website. Yep. A lot of great resources for producers there.
And that is free of cost, no subscriptions, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
Nice. And then you also mentioned AgriPulse, which is subscription, but a good resource as well.
Yep.
And then if anybody wants to follow more directly what you are putting out, then following you on LinkedIn is a great way of doing that as well.
Yes. And also I have a podcast. So agricultural policy podcast. It's called Smoke and Mirrors, Ag Policy Unfiltered. You could just Google that and it'll pop up. It's on all the platforms. I've been doing it for about 5 months now. And it's all about making sense of agricultural policy. So for a broader audience. So, you know, does this matter? Why should people care? And we've talked to, you know, we got producers. I got one of the Peterson brothers on, former senators, secretary of ag, medical doctors. We talked about E15, which is a hot topic. So we really do cover a lot of different things, trying to, again, make sense of agricultural policy. It's tough to navigate. I think the podcast format works pretty well for it because there is this kind of, how do you distill policy? You know, there's people that work on it that really, you know, kind of get into these things. So that's a resource, too, that I'd like to invite people to check out.
Nice. That's great, especially, you know, if you're traveling somewhere, if you can listen, but you cannot read because you have to pay attention to the road.
In the tractor. Helps with that. Yes. Listen to it in the tractor.
That's right. Yep. Great. Well, thanks for sharing all those great resources. Now, the second question of the three is very similar, right? So if you have a resource to share with us, however, outside of your technical area of expertise.
Yeah, I didn't think about that one much. I have two kids and most of my time is doing ag policy stuff or taking care of them. And I don't know. There's like too much parenting advice out there. It's kind of, we just kind of use our social network, I feel like. And it's try not to, there's so much. Yeah, it's tough. I don't have a single source, I'd say.
Nice. Yeah. Well, especially, you know, with the ease of sharing information of all sorts, I imagine it's very overwhelming if you go after that for any purpose, but Yeah, but I guess maybe perhaps what you're saying is using your social network for advice, at least in terms of parenting, would be a source.
Family, social network, I think just that. Usually if your kids are being difficult, you just have to talk to another parent and you realize it's normal. And then it's like, okay, this is hard. It's okay.
Right. Nice. Well, thanks for sharing that as well. And then the last of the three questions is, in your opinion, through your experience, people we ran into, what are the skills that you've observed that successful people have?
Right. Well, I'm going to have to talk about academia. So that's what I do. For farm profitability, it's managing your expenses. But that's I don't think that's what you mean. In our Kansas Farm Management Association data, the most profitable producers are the ones that keep their per acre expenses less. Shocking, right? Anyway, I think it's sort of the research and extension field. And I think, you know, technical expertise is necessary. But I think for people who, you know, are successful, there's this sort of, vision and leadership. So sort of kind of being able to identify, like being able to think about the big picture and, you know, what are the research questions that matter to people and sort of put together the pieces. Networking is a part of that because, you know, you have to work. It's very hard to work alone. But, you know, when I talk to PhD students or sort of new faculty, I say, like, you know, you've been so focused on learning some skills, and you absolutely have to, but, you know, slowly you need to start thinking about the big picture and, you know, developing a vision for your work and leadership with graduate students leadership. That's not my field. I don't quite know the word for that, but those skills are absolutely critical, I think.
I agree. You know, as an early career professor, I can definitely empathize with that, especially because I feel like, you know, part of that is when we become, you know, assistant professors, starting your career as a professor. There's so many things that you have to learn on the go that you were not trained during grad school.
Oh my goodness, it is crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. So and that's a big component. Having that vision and that leadership to start your own program is definitely a big one. Nice. All right, well, that wraps up our episode. Jennifer, thank you again for being our guest today. I really learned a lot and appreciate you sharing your thoughts on the Farm Bill, really educating us around those topics. Really enjoyed it.
Happy to be here.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.